Hello, welcome to Conversations. My name is Kayleen Welsh, and I am your host this week. And I have a guest today that I'm looking forward to talking with. Many of people in the local community know Michelle Ng. Hi, Michelle. And
hi.
I'll let you say hello. Hi, yeah. We'll talk a little bit more about you in just a second. But I just wanted to give a little bit of a backstory. You know, Conversations is designed to be a program where we really just get to know our neighbors a little bit, talk about things that are relevant to things in the community, and learn from each other's interests. And I guess Michelle and I met many years ago as we worked together on a project in Viroqua area for developing and sustaining a Big Brother Big Sister program.
Yes.
And so, yeah, that was a few years back, wasn't it, Michelle?
It was a few.
Yes, but anyway, you know, I recognized at the time Michelle's interest in making a difference in the community. And I think one of the things that's helpful to a community is just to kind of even know, like, what's going on around the world. And when I heard that Michelle had made a trip to the Mexican border, since I've known Michelle, she's become a pastor. I should probably introduce you as Pastor Michelle Ng. But Michelle, tell us a little bit about, like, you know, what's going on for you in the recent years. And yes, you verified for me this trip to the border. And when you did that, let's get started talking about that.
Sure, you're right. I was involved with Big Brothers Big Sisters. And yes, I have always wanted to make a difference in the community. Since my Coolie Cap Big Brothers Big Sisters time, I worked with Vernon County in a number of roles and tried to improve the community through that avenue. And after some time in the county, realized that I was not the best fit for the county and found my new passion in working for Westby Coon Prairie Church as their Faith Formation Director. During that time of serving in that community, I discovered a call to ordained ministry, and I went back to school and received a degree program through TEAM, Emerging Ministries, through Wartburg Seminary, and was ordained in April of 2021, although I've been serving at Emmanuel since August of 2019.
Yes, and again, just, you know, I think I just have to say that that's one of the things that I so admire about you is your commitment to community and to understanding a little bit more, you know, what people need and how to be of service. And so congratulations on that transfer, the faith transfer.
Yes.
Because I think faith is just another interesting piece that's being, you know, shifted around in our world right now. So, but anyway, let's get on to how did you get interested then in the immigration situation? What brought that?
Well, I've always been interested in the immigration situation. When I lived in Tucson, Arizona for about 8 years, I saw firsthand immigration taking place, people migrating north, and also was familiar with being back and forth across the border when we would go down to Nogales and visit Nogales and enjoy the culture of Mexico. And so I was back and forth across the border myself, and I knew people who had come across the border as well, both documented and undocumented. So it was, I sort of had the seeds planted at that time. Since being involved in my church, I have been interested and at the synod level has been involved with migrant justice. And at that level, we had the opportunity to take a trip to Las Cruces, New Mexico, and El Paso in January of this year. The trip was an interesting trip, to say the least, and I learned a lot about immigration that I was previously unaware of. And we left on January 27th, so exactly a week after the inauguration, which certainly made an interesting experience as well.
There's so much backstory to all of this, and this is one of the reasons that I think it's important that we have these conversations. because we can't all keep up on all the issues or be knowledgeable about all, because there's so much information. There's so much information that goes back and forth. And so I appreciate the opportunity here to hear from someone who I admire and respect, and your experience. Just really, what did you see, and what, you know, what do we need to be aware of? And of course, this all comes to the forefront as we see certainly questions about migrant justice that are going on currently.
Yes. I think what I found out first off was that a lot of the rhetoric was true in the presidential election, but that I had not been aware of. There was a lot of rhetoric about all of the immigration coming across the borders, southern border particularly, for all kinds of countries, and that Mexico was letting them in. And at the time, I discounted that. I did not realize what was actually happening. Up until noon on January 20th, we had a policy in place that allowed so many immigrants to access our border every month. And it was a way of trying to guide the border immigration through an asylum process that was completely legal and that would be sustainable for our country. That was the CBP-1 asylum status. The asylum status is available for people who are leaving their countries because of safety issues. And it involves people from Mexico, it involves people from South America, it involves people from Africa, it involves Ukrainians, it involves people from India. It is worldwide an asylum process. Mm-hmm. The only way of accessing that particular status is to enter at a legal port of entry along the southern border. You cannot access that asylum process by coming in through points of entry on the northern border, nor can you access it by coming flying to an airport. You have to meet at an assigned time with an appointment at your point of entry. What is interesting is that the U.S. set the whole system up that you had to be north of Mexico City in order to actually access the app needed to make that appointment. It was geolocated. So you might be in Africa and wanting in a country in Africa where you are unsafe and you want to access the U.S. You have to get from Africa to Mexico City, and then travel north in order to access the app. And then you aren't going to return and fly home to a country that you're unsafe in order to actually make your appointment, which are usually 6 months out.
Mm-hmm.
So
a complicated system.
It's a complicated system.
Impossible.
And it was set up by the U.S. government. And so the U.S. government set up a burden on Mexico to house and sustain all of these people who were trying to access our border. So the rhetoric was true in the election. The world's immigrants were accessing our southern border because of the system that we set up.
Has that system been in place for a long time, Michelle? What's the deal there?
That was set up in the Biden administration.
So,
was not set a long-term program, but it was a way of allowing people who needed access because of safety issues to do so and not overwhelm the border.
I see. Trying to limit it, yet at the same time give some access.
Yes. But that meant that Mexico has to bear a burden.
Right.
And when the border shut down at noon on January 20th, people who had actual appointments for 1 o'clock that day couldn't access the border. So Mexico now has people for the next 6 months who had appointments scheduled from January 20th to May 20th so that they now have no place to go. So we have put an undue stress on the Mexican government by our own actions and our policies.
It seems like there's a lot of stress to go around over this whole situation, and no matter, which is again why it's so important that we're able to talk about it. And I hope that even as we continue to talk, we get some ideas about what are some solutions, what can we do. And I can't imagine being a person who's trying to leave their country for a safety reason, or and then all that they go through to get now to Mexico and now are stalled out there.
Mm-hmm. And they are desperate.
So like when you're there, I mean, you were there at such a very interesting time, as you said, 1 week after the election and the border being shut down. When you arrive, can you just describe, what do you see?
What we saw was no one. I will be honest, that was the interesting thing. We saw the border wall. We went and toured the Border Patrol Museum, where we saw how Border Patrol tracks people in the desert, things that devices that people try to use to access the border illegally. We went to a Border Servant Corps safe house that was set up and funded by FEMA. That was rapidly being shut down. They knew at the end of December that they were going to have to modify what they were doing because they have to receive reimbursements as part of the FEMA grant that was funding it. But it was again set up in order to keep a way of people accessing the border through the asylum process, safety, and once they arrive, and then a plan to get to wherever they were going to, whoever their sponsor was. So they helped them, Border Servant Corps helped people navigate the airport. I mean, we met with the woman at the El Paso airport who had been at the airport one day and noticed that a woman was trying to access information on how to get to her plane and was treated really rudely. She didn't speak English, and the woman who did speak both English and Spanish stepped in and helped the woman navigate through an airport. And if you've never been to an airport and you've never been on an airplane, think of how confusing TSA lines are and how just accessing and getting a ticket. Mm-hmm. This woman, Cece, who is probably 75, was a little angry about it, and so she started to work at the airport and volunteer at the airport helping people who were accessing flights. And they were at that time, it was about 300 people, I believe, a week, if I remember my statistics, and I apologize, I might be a little rusty on those. It's been a couple of months. But it was 300 people a week accessing airplanes to get to locations where they had housing available. And so she formed a group of people, volunteers, who would help and navigate and walk with people who were just looking for ways to get to where they were going with dignity. The airport finally said, "You've been here so long, we're just giving you an office." And they set up an office for her.
Mm-hmm.
So what I saw in every place we went was how dignified and how people really tried to help immigrants with dignity and respect for who they were. That was very obvious when we went to the courthouse. We sat in the back of the courthouse federally, federal courthouse, and with a judge and about 35 people who had been picked up in the desert. And we watched and witnessed how they worked very hard to ensure that their rights to a fair trial were available to them. They had court interpreters who interpreted in first person the judge's words as well as the responses back from those who had been apprehended. They were a wide variety of ages sitting in that room, from 18 to 55. The 18-year-old, the judge stopped the hearing and made sure that he got date of birth because he wanted to make sure he wasn't working with a juvenile. They cleared the courtroom for a juvenile hearing. They had somebody who spoke a dialect from South America, and nobody was able to interpret. So they went ahead and gave him a new court date when they could bring an interpreter in to interpret for him. There was absolutely a care and dignity for all people. And I commented on how much care I watched from the marshals in the building to how the interpreters were putting headphones on people's heads and checking to make sure they understood how they were to be used. It was just a very good process all around. Not a great day for people, and that's what they all said. We met with the judge afterwards, and he said, I know these individuals are having one of their worst days ever, and I can treat them with dignity.
That's an important word, you know, dignity and respect. I'm glad to hear that that's what is your response to what you saw there, that people are being treated well. Some of the horror stories, of course, indicate otherwise, mm-hmm. and it's really nice to know that people are being cared for and treated with dignity and respect. I got to say that, you know, I'm in Mexico right now, and if I can get into my own difficulty at the airport. I don't speak Spanish. I mean, sure, it'd be nice if I did in their country, but I mean, thank goodness there's enough people that do speak English and that are helpful and kind. And that's what I found as a traveler. You know, certainly, you know, when people are helpful and kind, it all works together for everybody so much better.
It does. So that
was a sad situation, though. I mean, I'm glad that they were treated well, but yes, what a difficult place then that these people are really mm-hmm. left in.
And once you've the thing that I don't think Americans are aware of is that when you've accessed the border illegally, you now have a criminal record. And that pretty much shuts down any legal opportunity for you to gain status in the United States. And when we shut our borders and close our borders, people are desperate. If they can't access it through a legal means, they try the illegal. One of the things that I know we're coming up on time to break, so maybe I'll hold off on that story. But I would say,
sure. Why don't we? Okay, go ahead.
I would say that, you know, the numbers of people detained were vastly different from what I expected as well, and I can talk more on that later.
All right. Well, let's just come back to that story in a minute, Michelle. And I will just remind listeners that you are listening to WDRT Community Radio, and this is Conversations, a show designed to just get some dialogue going between our friends, neighbors, and around topics of interest. And so thanks for tuning in. If you like the programs and other programming WDRT has, you can always find programs in the archives if you miss things live. But tell your friends, and thanks for listening. All right, Michelle. Sounds like you got a story for us.
Well, I was just going to say, I think some of the situations with closing our borders does lead to safety issues for a lot of people. People coming through who are coming from places where we do not have consulates, we have no access to do background checks. So people from Venezuela, Haiti, Cuba, we do not have a consulate there. And so that's part of the conflict with people from Venezuela. We have no way of checking backgrounds when they're coming across the border legally to know if they are coming in for a good reason or for a not so good reason. And we also have no way of returning people to Venezuela, Haiti, or Cuba because we don't have a consul presence there. We can't return them. That makes it very difficult. And so, yes, when there's, again, rhetoric from the last election, and this was something that completely surprised me. One of my takeaways was there was a lot of truth in the election that I just didn't know the background of. And so, yes, we have no way of checking backgrounds of people coming from countries where we do not have a presence in that country. That's not to say... everybody from Venezuela is a bad person. It's just to say we don't have the ability to check on that. And
I think
that's a problem.
It seems like it reflects on just the bigger government system. You know, I guess I don't always know how it all fits together and how things do work. And so you're right, though. I'd never even really thought about that. You know, if we don't have a background or a consulate there, then we've got no way to really, like, vet people until they get here, until they're here. And even then, we don't, so we're limited. So as you see some of those kinds of things happening, I mean, it sounds like you were surprised to hear that some of the rhetoric you were hearing was correct, or, I mean, it started making more sense to you.
It started to make more sense.
What is your takeaway then from this? Because, I mean, clearly we still have immigration mess and we still have a lot going on in the country over this whole issue, no matter where people are coming from. While on the other side, then too, the opportunity to kind of get a golden ticket, whether that's another thing to talk about. But what's your takeaway from your experience?
My takeaway is we need to do a better job educating ourselves. And then we need to act on that education. I would have been out educating the public that, yeah, we don't have a way of vetting people from Venezuela. We need to do better or figure out a system to do so.
Mm-hmm.
We need to advocate with people who have the ability to change the rules and the laws of this land and make sure that we're setting up systems that make sense. I think the Biden administration's plan to limit access but to have a legal point of entry was great. I think it was short-sighted in the burden it placed on our neighbors to the south, and it also needed to be more complete and maybe not geolocated right where you have to have it located anywhere so that people could move to the border from the countries they're in and travel and make more, it would be more sustainable and less risky.
Mm-hmm. Well, and am I correct that there is no, you can't get asylum in the U.S. through the Mexican border now?
No.
Right? Is that been
that
cut off?
Was shut down at noon on January 20th.
Gotcha.
So there were people standing in line who had already been vetted from 10 o'clock until noon when that border shut, even though they had been vetted at the border they couldn't walk across.
Yeah. What do you think that impact has on the United States?
I think that impact is going to have a lot of problems in the future for us. Let's face it, people who are here working with asylum and parolees have legal status in the United States. They are not undocumented. They have work permits, they are paying into Social Security, and they are able to work at a lot of jobs that, let's face it, none of us want. If we wanted to, we'd be working at them. We're not, which is why people and employers are looking for a workforce that's willing to work in some pretty difficult occupations and for lower wages. And I think we as a country that relies on services and food and agriculture are going to see a backlash when we don't have the people to staff that. And the people who are paying into the Social Security system, who are here working under permits, are paying into a system that they aren't going to draw from. That makes me, you know what? Why are we banning them from working and paying into our Social Security system? They can't draw from it, but they have to pay into it.
I see. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and seeing, you know, some of these things, you're right, I'm not educated on. You know, I hear some of these things, oh, people get all these benefits when they come here, or people can do this, or people can do that. And so, I mean, I think you're right about our need to educate ourselves and to have some of these conversations from people that do know. And I guess I am also thinking about the impact on the United States as far as, I guess I would say it, the human piece, because it seems like we're an integrated enough, you know, group of people these days that I guess I know that I have people that have into the United States from other countries who have become my friends or mm-hmm. part of my family. Mm-hmm. What does this do to that?
I think this is going to be very devastating for families. I know that people who have documented statuses and people who are undocumented, and they're all afraid because it seems like right now it doesn't matter if you have a status that's legal, you're still going to get detained. And that's very scary for so many people, especially if you have children who have been born in the United States and are American citizens.
And so as you watched people, like in that courtroom, you know, as you sat in on the hearings and such, can you just give us a snapshot of some of those people? I mean, you talked about an 18-year-old that, mm-hmm. you know, the judge wanted to make sure. Well, who are these people?
They are people who are desperate, is the best way I can say. Obviously, we were listening, but we couldn't interpret all their story. They didn't have an opportunity to share their story. So maybe I will take an opportunity to share. I met with a family that was one of the last families who came across the border prior to January 20th. It's a family with three small children. They were waiting to fly out of the Border Servant Corps' home and our sanctuary area, and they had a sponsor, they had asylum, they had a work permit. Their story is that they were in South America, in Venezuela. They, from my understanding, please understand, this is all through Google Translate and subject to maybe some variations on both their side and my side. But what they shared with me was that the female parent ran a store in Venezuela, just a small clothing store. Her husband raised avocados and lemon on farmland that they owned. They were not wealthy. They were stable, is what she would say. So I would say my idea of stable is not poor, but not able to afford everything you want, or like the rest of us. And that her husband wanted to expand the farm and went to who he thought was a government agency to take out a loan to buy more land. They did so. They were starting to plant. And it turns out that they had asked the wrong person for a loan. It was not a governmental agency. And they demanded payment in full or to turn over their two young daughters for human trafficking. The parents left that night. They said their goodbyes. They packed up their children. And they walked from Venezuela through the Darien Gap all the way to the U.S. border.
I can't imagine the terror of that, and I can't imagine how easily things can go awry. I mean, there's so much scam and greed in places. So, I mean, I can totally see, you know, someone building their life, getting caught up in the opportunity even to borrow from a certain place and then, you know, having it go awry so badly. But to be terrorized, I mean, I always want to ask myself, what would I do? You know, what would I do if someone, you know, said that they were going to take my children?
Mm-hmm. This wasn't their choice. I mean, they were happy in Venezuela. They had a family in Venezuela. They will never see one. They showed me pictures at the sanctuary of their 100-year-old grandmother that they will never see again.
This is heartbreaking.
This is the reason they came to the U.S. They didn't want to. They weren't necessarily anticipating this change in their life, but they needed a place where they could raise their children in safety. And that's all that they were looking for. I asked him what kind of jobs he would do. He said, I will work in a kitchen. I will work farmland. I can Uber drive. And I'm going, well, no, you can't get a license in the U.S., so, or at least in our area. I know there are some states you can. So, you know, there are all kinds of barriers for the jobs he was willing to take. But again, he was willing to do anything to support his family.
Yeah, this is a tough time. I mean, this is just a tough situation. It's heartbreaking to hear stories like that, and yet, you know, you hear story after story.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to say that there aren't stories on the other side of people who've been trafficked. I know that one of the sad statistics I heard is that there's about 1,000 children still from the first Trump presidency that have not been reunited with their families after they were separated. However, they shared that the Border Patrol person that we were talking to, who I want to clarify, we did not actually have the opportunity to speak to Border Patrol. It was on our schedule, but they were shut down all of their interviews and meeting with outside groups was shut down after January 20th. So we did not have the opportunity to meet with them. We met with a woman who was the humanitarian for the Border Patrol. She'd worked in the Biden and the Obama administrations. She was out of her job as of January 20th. And she spoke at length, and she's the one where she shared that they had 1,000 children still remaining in foster homes because they could not be reunited. But the belief was that they were all trafficked children and that they were headed to the U.S. for purposes that we can't even imagine or we don't want to imagine.
Oh, God, yeah, that's just so, yes, it's disgusting. It's just totally disgusting, and we don't want to imagine. That's the hard part for so much of this, isn't it? Yeah. It's just things that we just go about our busy lives about, and we don't really pay a lot of attention to. And, I mean, again, I go back to, God, there's only so many things and so much time in a day, and, yeah, how do I learn about everything, and how do I sort through all the information and know what's accurate? So I guess I'm so grateful, again, to have the opportunity to talk to people that have experiences. And this is why we do need to be talking and educating each other and learning and sharing. I recognize that, you know, I don't know, there's a lot of crowdedness in our cities. I feel so grateful to live in the Driftless area where I do, where there's room to be. I'm so grateful for my opportunity to travel to Mexico, and I feel like, I don't know, heavy burden for the country of Mexico with all that they try to hold and contain. And, of course, all of my experiences have been so positive and the people so kind and welcoming. And there, in many ways, I see a demonstration of values that I feel sometimes can get lost. As you talk about, like, the picture of the family, the 100-year-old grandma, you know, hopefully we retain a lot of that in our smaller communities, our extended families, and our need for just connection with people.
Yes.
So this is just tragic on so many levels, and yet it does feel like somehow or other the United States has room for people. How can we not accommodate? And we're richer. I certainly, clearly have a more leaning viewpoint of in favor of diversity.
Yes.
How do we do that?
Interestingly enough, even though the rhetoric states that we're taking more people than anyone else in the world, that is actually disproven. Our European siblings actually receive more immigrants than the United States does. There are places... let me see if I can find the statistic quickly. We are actually like down 10 or 11 on how many people we take. And yet you are correct. We are one of the places that have the most resource rich. So Europe receives 86% of immigrants. Asia receives 85%. 86 million went to Europe, 85 million went to Asia, 58 million came to North America in 2020. We are almost less than half of what the world is taking on.
And And it's so ironic to me because we're a country of immigrants.
Yes.
I mean, it doesn't even make sense to me. That doesn't even make sense.
Mike, I'm pretty sure, and I probably shouldn't announce this on the radio, but I'm 99% certain, because I can't find any manifesto from a ship leaving Ireland, that my dear great-great-great-great-grandfather, Patrick O'Connell, was an illegal citizen. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure he came across the border illegally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can all find examples of them, I bet, in our family mm-hmm. tree. And not to jump subjects too often here, but my brain kind of went back to this whole human trafficking thing, too. You know, where are those kids? What a horrible, horrific situation. And again, I want to think about the United States being such a, you know, a country for good.
Mm-hmm.
How can this be happening?
Human trafficking occurs for a number of reasons. People want to raise a child in their home to be their housemaid or cleaning crew. And I've watched documentaries where they talk about the human trafficking is turning into a slavery-based type system where we take children from other countries and use them for labor. It's wrong and injustice.
Yeah. Well, and we've never really gotten over the slavery issue then, have we?
No.
And I find it very interesting in my study of astrology, but to see these repeating cycles and just to know that we're in a cycle that's very relevant or very similar to the cycle of the Civil War right now, the whole slavery issue in Civil War. I mean, it's so coming up for review again. And really, I guess I'm really hoping that as a country, we do figure out how to respond differently.
I
would like to think, how can we be a bunch of people from different places with the melting pot of families and such neighborhoods and things that we do that we are not somehow, I don't know, just
I would
more
say
compassionate.
That it's interesting because when I've looked into the historic roots of our immigrant siblings, they were not given great things when they came to the United States, and still they came. They worked as maids, and Irish maids were a thing. People lived four or five families in, the flats that were built in New York City. It was just a time where we didn't treat people with dignity either. That's the sad thing. Our history of immigration, our grandparents may have made something of themselves when they came over, but they certainly didn't have an easy walk to do so. And I think we've forgotten that, and that we have a history in our country where we do not treat the immigrant well, and we never have. And I think that is something we need to change and recognize that we are all prodigy of the immigrant, but we don't treat immigrants well.
Yes, no, we don't. Thank you for that, Michelle. I'm sorry for my interruptions there, but let's come back to that, and let's just do another brief little break and remind people that thanks for listening, and you are listening to a program called Conversations on WDRT Community Radio, and feel free to tune in every Thursday morning for this same program. And if you miss it, feel free to check it out in WDRT archives at WDRT.org. So, and today I'm speaking with Pastor Michelle Eng, and we're just talking about her experience of visiting the border, the Mexican border, and talking about immigration and what it's like for immigrants. And we were just speaking about that it's never been an easy place for immigrants to come. When you said that, Michelle, it made me think about my ancestors. One side, some German immigrants, some mm-hmm. Irish immigrants. I'm not sure exactly whether they came legally or how they came. I never even really thought about that whole process. I suppose if they're documented somewhere, it was some legal thing. But, yeah, they had the opportunity, to move to basically my heart of the Driftless, where I grew up around, you know, northeast corner of Iowa, had just been opened up from Indian land. And so the immigrants came and were able to, you know, get a plot of land, and but, you know, it was trees and nothing or whatever. They had to work it and build it and create their lives. At the same time, you know, it's this ongoing thing. We moved the Native Americans out to let those immigrants in.
Yes.
But they weren't, yeah, I don't know, you know, I guess they were given land, but it wasn't an easy life.
No, it wasn't. The westward expansion was devastating to the Native people of this country. And my ancestors were part of that as well. My on one side of the family, I have the person who came in the 1850s illegally, probably. The other side of that family, I traced my ancestors to William Penn's westward expansion of Pennsylvania. And I've got people that landed here in the early 1600s. Our immigrant history has been difficult for many cultures, including our own Native population.
Is that just this, what is that about? Why is it so difficult for us to accept other cultures? Why is it? Is it because, you know, they're just people are different? Somehow we don't understand, we don't feel comfortable. What is it about other cultures that we find it so difficult to embrace?
I just looked at the clock, and I'm not sure we have enough time to discuss that.
Okay, yeah, that's a
I'm serious.
Big topic, isn't it?
I've taken a lot of classes on that and the history of why does Northern European ancestry for many years see themselves better than people who traditionally are of color, including our Jewish, Palestinian, African American, Native American, and people of color today that are from all countries. We just have not had a good history with that. And because of that, we've lived into systems that were set up to keep people in privilege, and we need to work to acknowledge that we have benefited from that privilege, whether we want to admit to it or not. And we have to figure out the systems to allow our siblings of color to come alongside us. That's a great expansion project. That's not
yeah.
the narrative we hear, though.
Yeah. And is it fear? Is it just so we're so afraid that, oh my gosh, if we let somebody else have it, there's not going to be enough for us?
I think that's probably the baseline. And I think that's where, you know, the baseline of even the Jim Crow era back in the early 1900s, you know, it was, we can't let the slaves have 40 acres and a donkey because that's what they were promised. Because if we do that, that's going to take away land from people who should have it, meaning the white landowner.
Oh, boy. And yet that seems like that took us down a very slippery slope into some cruelty.
It did.
But and now, if we are in a position to relook at this whole idea of, I forget exactly the word, slavery-based system in some ways, as you referred to it, I don't know, how do we, like, come back to recognize, I guess I'm always appalled at the amount of cruelty that people can bring. So how do we build compassion? I guess that's our task, isn't it?
It really is. It's to walk with people where they're at and accept them for who they are. In the language of my church, every person I meet is a beloved child of God, and I need to acknowledge that they are a beloved child of God. And that may not be your faith tradition, but that's where compassion stems from, is recognizing that no matter what, whoever that person I encounter, that person is a human being just like I am.
Well, that seems to be a kind of a question of where we're at, I guess. To me, in some ways, that whole question reflects where we're at as a world, as a society. And yet, hearing your stories of your experience in Mexico, of people being treated with dignity and respect, I really hope that there are ways that we can find to come back to that, even if we're afraid that maybe there isn't going to be enough to go around. I don't know why we would ever think that, because it just feels like we live in such an abundant world, and people are so creative, and there's just so many ways that we could make this work differently. It does feel like we've gotten kind of really caught in bogged down systems that are like they're trying, but they just, you know, aren't really working. You know what anybody's trying. We need to really do have some revolution or new ideas or out of the box and try some things different. And I personally loved your story about the woman at the airport who recognized that she could be helpful to people just by helping them, you know, because she could speak the language. So she could help make that, reduce that stress for them at the airport and help them out.
She was quite a character. I appreciated her story so much.
Well, and I believe, Michelle, that we are at a point where there is a lot of dignity and respect. People are kind and helpful overall. That these are the people that we are, and that even as we see things of cruelty and hear these stories of human trafficking, I really want to believe that they're the minority. How do we, like, strengthen the majority of kindness and compassion?
I think you're starting right where we need to start, with conversation. I think we don't know our neighbor, and we don't understand our neighbor. And that might be the neighbor whose house is sitting right next door to ours. We have become such introspective, maybe, families, where we come home, we're tired, we close our doors, we eat dinner, we watch TV, but we don't engage the community. And we really need to have places and spaces. And I know third spaces are coming up all over the place and are being a meeting place for where people are at. I just think there is such a hunger for community connection. And it's in the community when we get to know each other's story that we can work towards common issues. I've been a part of the Kickapoo conversation since its inception in, I want to say, 2014, and that's what it is. It's getting to know our community and the community's story, building relationships, listening, and then I know who and what skills and who and what needs are there, and I can pair them together as a connector. Or I find things that I didn't even know were needs in the community and work towards fixing that broken system.
I really like that idea of kind of just connecting everyone, weaving the skills and the talents and the needs and everything together. It seems like maybe in some ways we relied too much on outsiders to do that or something.
I think it really is. The community is a beautiful tapestry of people. And I may have a need for X, and you may have extra X's in your skill set or whatever. It's sharing our resources honestly and with dignity. And not looking down on me because I need your X, but sharing your gift of X, because maybe tomorrow you're going to need a gift of A, and I happen to have plenty of A's today.
Well, it has me just thinking that we are all only just what, as great as the sum of our parts. There's only, you know, we can utilize and support and encourage and, I don't know, be with each other, you know, at which enhances all of us then.
Yes, certainly. I'm hoping to lead another trip down to the border. That's on my bucket list in the next year. My goal is to take a group of interested community members down and to see the border. I don't know what changes will be present in a year's time. I'm very curious about that. I also want to see how we can hear the stories of people who are migrants and why and what we can do to help fix the situation.
Mm-hmm. You know, I guess I wonder, Michelle, it sounds like this has been something you've been aware of and interested in, and then this trip, you know, has probably opened things up. And again, your role as a pastor with the Lutheran Church, how has this changed you, or what remnant does this leave for you?
It's probably made me more passionate about the issue, I would say. It has led me to realize that I need to search out answers and not just listen to rhetoric in elections and discount it, but to understand why it's coming out and what does it really truly mean. I think it just means that it has reinforced the sense that I have as a person and that I see Emmanuel doing, is that we need to walk with one another and to really make sure that we meet the needs of the people in our community.
I have to say that I have been a student of spirituality in various religions for a good part of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very drawn to the idea of that I know is longstanding in the Lutheran Church, as far as being taking the church outside of the walls, I guess I would say, you know, taking it out into the community.
Yes. And I would say that that's a basis from Lutheranism. I think the ELCA, which is the type of Lutheran church I belong to, definitely looks at more social justice issues.
Well, and it does seem like social and cultural justice issues are, I guess I'll say, in our face.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's definitely a topic, and it's definitely something that we as individuals and as communities need to address.
Coming from my faith tradition, when I read the Bible, I see a lot of really good social justice issues being addressed by Jesus, for example. So it was a system that was broken when he walked the earth. We haven't done much better since he's walked the earth, and I think we're called to do better.
Do you have ideas on that? What can we do?
Again, I think the baseline is just loving each other, because if you're loving somebody, you can't hate them. And that,
oh, but
that's hard.
It can be hard.
It can be really hard. I know. I struggle with it every day. It's certainly not easy, but it's what we're called to do. And it's called, when we encounter those differences, to stop and listen. Because you might have a truth that I don't like, but I need to hear that truth. And I might have a truth that you don't like, but you also need to consider it. Again, dignity, respect.
Well, and I guess I'd have to throw in there, where has hatred taken us?
I would say hatred is everything that we try and hide in this country as far as our history with people of color.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to own up to it.
Yeah, we are good at denial, and it's just easier to put it out of mind. I think just a lot of things.
Yes.
So, and yet I have to appreciate the struggles that we're having as a country and as a world right now, because I do believe that it's calling these things to attention. They are things that have needed to be addressed and that needed to be called to attention, and we need to have conversations about and learn about.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I'm very grateful, Michelle, for your efforts and to learn and study and understand the situation, and to take on that project of going down to the Mexican border and trying to get a sense of everything you can to understand it as best you're able, and then to come back and share with us what you learned so that, you know, we all have an opportunity to learn a little bit more. And to me, again, that's one of the great values of a community and community radio, right? What a great opportunity to
Absolutely.
Learn about each other and learn about each other's interests and passions. And just we all are enriched by that experience. So
yes, and I think your show as conversation is a good way of opening further conversation out in our community.
Yeah, well, I look forward to talking more, Michelle.
Sounds good.
Do you have any thoughts? Yeah, I guess it's time to wrap this up. So do you have any closing thoughts you'd like to share?
I would share that I think there's a lot of hope in this world today. It's hard to see some days. I tend to avoid news because I'm questioning what's true and what's not, but I do have some trusted resources, and I keep up with it because I can't put my head in the sand. And yet, I think hope exists, and it's going to be working with all people that we can make a difference in this world.
Well, and I have to throw in kind of my little two cents on that, because I really love studying astrology and the goddesses and just mm-hmm. history and mythology. And, you know, Pandora's box, you know, Pandora's box has been opened, and there's a lot of messes all over the place here. But really, what was left when everything else was empty out of her box was hope.
Exactly.
How do we hang on to hope? Hope is the foundation.
And I think all spiritual traditions come down to that, which is hope.
Thanks a lot, Michelle. Thanks for being here
Thank
and sharing
you.
Your experience.
It's All been right. a great Thanks. Joy.